take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the continent to bring you the truth about cannabis and marijuana law reform.
I smoke pot and I like it a lot.
Yeah! The Russ Belville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation. Now, here's your host, Radical Russ Belville.
Well, on the
joined by Councilperson David Grosso, who's an active, large member of the D.C. City Council, so he's not going to be in any particular jurisdiction here. He's elected by all of us. He's a D.C. native, which is a pretty rare thing, frankly. And yet he spent a lot of time on a farm in Virginia. This is the first hint. He graduated from Earlham with a degree in philosophy. That's your second hint. And he went to Georgetown Law School, where I think Keith Stromp went to school as well. He's well-traveled. He spent a lot of time outside of the country in Honduras and helping the poor in San Antonio. That's your fourth hint, that David is a really genuine person regarding how he has gotten to his stature in politics. He worked for a city councilwoman for years, Sharon Ambrose, who was very progressive, and later Eleanor Holmes Norton, our congresswoman, and is a stalwart in the civil rights movement in the United States. I was in a meeting with her one time where the head of the ACLU was there, Ira Glasser. And Ira Glasser told the story of how he hired Eleanor Holmes Norton in the 1970s, and the very first case he assigned her was to represent racists down in the South. And I've been on many panels with Eleanor Holmes Norton, and we hope someday she enjoys the full vote of a congresswoman. Mr. Grosso is bright, to say the least. He's energetic. His policy making is clear right from the beginning what things matter to him in his ascendancy. And we're blessed to have him here to share part of our day. There are 535 members of Congress. And that's a pretty unwieldy group. But I would ask, would anybody here like to take a guess how many state legislators there are? And I think of Mr. Grosso as a state legislator. Anybody? 7,800 state politicians. So at Normal, we have to work with hundreds, if not thousands, of state politicians. And when I wrote to David asking him whether he could speak today, I wanted him to know that of the many thousands of state politicians we've worked with, we have never seen one come out of the gate as strong and full-voiced for marijuana law reform than David. When he got elected in 2012, you would not think it was one of his major priorities, but he certainly made it so in the ensuing years on the committee. He's championed medical marijuana here in town. There are about 3,000 registered patients. There are 3 dispensaries here in town. He's trying to get emergency legislation passed to get another cultivation center going because we don't have enough supply here. Decriminalization began July 1st of 2014, and David was also a champion of that. And of course, we know here in the district, voters like myself voted at the 70th percentile to legalize marijuana, but the term I think more properly employed earlier was depenalize marijuana. But David has argued strongly that we need legalization. It's kind of the obvious next step, and has helped with the other with the mayor and the city council to stave off Congress from stopping the implementation of these laws. So we've asked David here to come and talk about why he gives such a high priority to this, why DC voters likely at the 70 percentile support legalization and marijuana law reform. But I guess my strong point I want to make here in bringing David up is that I can literally think of a few politicians who in their ascendancy supported legalization. I can name you dozens to hundreds who in their descendancy out of politics, when there was going to be no more vote, when they were not going to raise any more money, when they're not going to get before the cameras. One can think about Bill Clinton. Right? The first interview he gave when he left the presidency was to Jan Wenner at Rolling Stone. And Jan called up and he says, listen, I have this interview with the president. I want to ask him some drug-related questions. And so we helped formulate a question, which was like, more people were arrested on your watch than at any other time as a president, more than Nixon. So what is your view post-presidency on marijuana? And he said, oh, I think it should be decriminalized. He was the president for 8 years. He fought every aspect of marijuana law reform. And more contemporary, think about Barbara Boxer, awesomely powerful senator from Colorado, from California. But only when she declared that she was not going to run did she finally come out in favor of major drug policy reform. We don't have to worry about that with David. From the very beginning, he has been a clear voice. And when he's done with his remarks, we have an award for him, and we'll talk a little bit about that award. Thank you, David, for coming and speaking here today. David Grosso, DC City Council.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, and thank you, Alan. You pretty much covered everything, so, you know, I mean. You know, it's interesting. I have to run for re-election next year, so you're making me a little nervous. Maybe I, you know, should have waited until after my second term to actually come out on this. You know, I didn't really want to come out and work on this issue. In fact, I knew all along in my life and the experiences that I've had in my life that it was important to do, and I knew that it was necessary for our country to move past prohibition of marijuana and drugs in our country. I knew that the war on drugs had failed, and I knew that it was time for us to move to a new place here. But I had other priorities. I was hoping to be fully engaged on education issues and on health and human services issues, which are so important to the people of our city. And now I am the chair of the Committee on Education, so I'm able to do that, and I'm really proud of that. The reason why I ended up coming out and trying to get marijuana legalized and move forward with a tax and regulate plan here in the District of Columbia is a little bit complicated, but I want to let you all know a little bit why I did it. Like I said, I didn't start out wanting to do this. You can ask my staff. I did it resistingly, but in the spring of my first year in office, which would have been 2013, I went out to Patuxent State Prison in Maryland and got to participate in the program called the Alternative to Violence Program, which was put on there by a group, mostly Quakers, but some other folks, where we spent 3 days in a maximum security prison with about 30 inmates, learning what it was like to really practice nonviolence in a setting like that, which is, as you can imagine, an extremely violent setting. They've been doing that for 25 plus years in this prison. So for me, it was an opportunity to learn what it's like to go to jail, what it's like to be dealing with those kinds of issues every day. And this program was interesting, but the kind of point that I took away with it, one of the points was that of the 25 or so inmates that were running this program, the average age was about 22, 23, and almost all of them were nonviolent drug offenders. They were not violent, robberies or murder or things like that. And most of them were serving more than 10 years for three strikes, you're out stuff. So this was not a, this was a real thing for these folks. And so that was something that impacted me. Then following that, I read Michelle Alexander's New Jim Crow book. And if you think about the, you know, kind of the incredible amount of effort that's been put into putting people behind bars in this country over the past 20, 30, 40 years, and then you read her book and you see how unjust it is and how unfair it is across the board, you begin to have to reflect on that. You have to think, well, if you're in a position of power, what do you have to do to change that? And then further in that summer, the ACLU and the Washington Lawyers Committee came out with a study in the District of Columbia that noted that 91% of everyone that was arrested for nonviolent marijuana offenses were people who are African Americans in our city, even though it was equal 50-50 people who actually smoked marijuana in the District of Columbia. So if you put those things together, you start to realize why when I thought about how I was going to have an impact on that, there was really only one answer to that, and that was to try to put a program in place that would tax and regulate marijuana just like alcohol in the district and ultimately send fewer and fewer people to jail. We did then introduce that bill, my staff and I did, in the September of that year, and I was the only one on it. So I think that's an interesting timeline kind of snippet there. I couldn't get any of my colleagues to join me. None of them co-sponsored it on the dais. It was just me on the bill. We were in the midst of, and I'll give credit to my colleague Tommy Wells and others who were working on decriminalization and had started doing that earlier in the year. So some of them didn't get on it because they thought decrim would be enough. I made the argument that in the end, you know, we really have to regulate it and stop sending everybody to jail for this stuff. So we moved forward from there, and the kind of the history, Initiative 71 passed, and I was really grateful to the work that was done on that because it elevated the conversation and allowed me to go out in the community and continue to educate on this issue and to continue to talk to the community and talk to the neighbors. One thing that I know is that when I talk to folks for more than 10 minutes, they always, almost always, I say, agree that we should stop the prohibition on marijuana in the District of Columbia. I think the vote was indicative of this with 71%, but I think also if you just talk to the grandmothers who have children that have gone to jail for nonviolent drug offenses or the brothers and sisters that have had their brothers and sisters go to jail for this, you start to realize that it's pervasive, especially in the poorest of the poor communities in the District of Columbia, and that the only alternative we have really to get out of that quagmire was to go ahead and regulate it like we do alcohol. So we introduced it, and we had some hearings on it, but more than anything, I was able to get out into the community and talk to people and really engage on these forums. There was a few people that would be put on the panels with me, as you can imagine, that were very against this, and the arguments just didn't stand up anymore. You know, the reality is that the war on drugs has failed and that it's time for us to move forward to a new place. So I also, and I just want to note one other bill I introduced at the same time that I think is just as important. This bill would seal the records of anyone who has had a nonviolent marijuana offense in the past in the District of Columbia. This is the only jurisdiction where we've done this. That bill passed unanimously and is now law in the District of Columbia. So if you had a misdemeanor or felony nonviolent offense in the District of Columbia in the past, you know, I felt like it'd be uncool to just let it go forward. I couldn't quite let you out of jail because our inmates are in the Bureau of Prisons in the federal system, as you know, probably, maybe you don't, but we don't have a local jail system or prison system in D.C., so our inmates, once you get sentenced to a long term, go on to Colorado and California and other places, and it'd be very hard to get them to come back, although some did that back in the day when we changed the sentencing disparities for crack and powder cocaine. We were able to get some folks released early, which I think would be important here if we could do it. But since we can't do it, as soon as you get out of jail for a nonviolent offense, you can go down to the court, and we were able to do a little different than expungement. We were able to put the law in place so that the court has the burden to prove why you shouldn't have your record sealed. And your record is sealed all the way through your arrest record, not just your court proceeding or your court case. So this is a real effort to try to make it so people can go on to a higher education, can get jobs, can get public housing in the District of Columbia. This is in effect right now in the district, and we are slowly rolling out our plan to advertise it. So I hope you guys will keep that in mind. I want to note the reason why we don't have tax and regulate in D.C. And I think it's important for you guys, since you're going to be going up to the Hill tomorrow, and I hope that you'll keep us in mind while you're up there. The only reason why the District of Columbia doesn't have tax and regulate is because we don't have full voting rights. And we're the only jurisdiction in the country. We have 650,000 residents who do not have a vote in Congress. We do not have two senators. We do not have a voting member of the House. Alan mentioned Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton. She's our non-voting member of the House. She has a lot of the same rights, but she can't vote on final bills. When I worked with her, we got her a vote in the Committee of the Whole, which is the step right before the House votes on things, which was a big deal. They had Democrats were in charge, and they gave her that Committee of the Whole. But even the Democrats told her and put in the rules, unless it's a tie. So her vote was essentially meaningless even then. So what we need, it'd be fine. Like, you know, I would love to have two senators. I would love to be a state and everything. But we can manage. We have balanced budgets for the past 18 years. We can manage without it, except for the fact that they like to meddle in our business on a regular basis. So whether it's, you know, reproductive health issues, gun issues, drug issues, a great example, and I don't mean to ramble on here, but a great example is the needle exchange program. I don't know if any of you know what this is, but it's a program that gives you a clean needle if you're an addict, to try to stop the spread of diseases between intravenous drug users. The District of Columbia for years was prohibited by Congress from implementing that with not just federal money, but also our local money. And so, you know, our spread of HIV and Hep C went on and on and on because we couldn't implement this, even though we knew in places like Baltimore and other places this was an extremely effective methodology. Ironically, we are allowed to do it now with our local money, not our federal money. But ironically, Governor Pence, who is the governor of Indiana, used to be in Congress, and he was one of the ones that fought on this really intently and constantly put riders on our budget that would stop us from spending our own money on this health initiative, now has an enormous problem, an epidemic in the state of Indiana with the spread of Hep C and HIV. And he is now having to adopt the needle exchange program in Indiana because he realizes that it works. Now, they put all these things on us, and you know, ultimately what happens is it's a small minority of folks that make it their number one issue. So we have folks up on the Hill that think that we are a petri dish of some sort, that they can try out issues on us or gain credit in other places. For example, Marco Rubio, who's running now, right before he announced he was going to run for office, he introduced a bill that said in Congress that said that all D.C. gun laws are, you know, totally wiped clean. There's no D.C. gun laws. And so he didn't get it passed. But that was, a little thing for the NRA to say, you know what, there's not going to be any gun laws. I'll fight for that. The only reason he did that in D.C. is because in Florida they already have that. So he couldn't actually go and make that happen in Florida. So he just did it here in D.C. to get more points. That's what they've done with marijuana now. So we have some of these knuckleheads that are up there on the Hill that are trying to intervene on us with our drug policy in spite of the facts, in spite of the reality that sending people to jail doesn't make any difference here and that it only makes things worse, in spite of the reality that the majority of the people that are arrested prior to decriminalization and prior to Initiative 71 were African Americans, and that continues today when it comes to where do you buy your drugs. You buy your marijuana. You know, some people can get somebody to come to their house, and perhaps that's safe. But when you're an African-American selling it on the street, you're still arrested for it. And so until we get full regulation of marijuana, we haven't won. Until we get to the point where we have stores that can be put in place that can help make sure that it's not sold to minors, that can help make sure that people who need help can get help and pay, and make sure that, in the end, no one's getting arrested with an underground market. Until then, we haven't really won. So I reintroduced the bill in spite of Congress in January. My staff and I then had to go on a list up to the congressional committee where we were a little nervous at first, but then we realized they don't have any power. So it didn't bother us that much, right, Christina? I mean, right. Well, in the end, they can come down on us, and they have. And they said that we're not allowed to spend any time or money on the regulation of marijuana in the District of Columbia. That's a rider on our budget that they passed in December. We will wait, and hopefully in September, when they have to do the next budget, that they can take that rider off of there. And that's what I'd be asking you guys to politely mention when you're lobbying, is that just go in and say, can you please not support a rider being put on D.C.'s budget so the people of the District of Columbia can have their desire respected, and their desire is to stop the war on drugs in D.C. and to move forward with the full legalization in the nation's capital. So with that, I want to thank you all for having me here today. I want to thank you for coming here and doing this. It's not every day that folks take time out of their busy lives to come down and lobby Congress, and I think it is important. I think if nothing else, it'll lock in some folks that can understand what the issues are across the country. It wasn't hard for me to make this decision because of all the things that I told you about, but ultimately, it's also not hard for me because I believe it's the right thing to do. And everything I do up here is based in some human rights framework, in some justice framework, and I believe wholeheartedly that expanding the jails and putting more people in jails is the wrong thing to do, and I'm going to continue to fight against that for as long as I'm an elected official. So thank you very much.
Thank you, David, and to be fair, he was very equitable. When he says they, what he's really talking about are Republicans. And so here in D.C., since it hews so very strongly Democratic, and I'm only speaking analytically or not in a partisan way, it is only when Republicans are in control of Congress that they meddle with D.C. government. So looking forwardly, David and his peers will likely have success only when Republicans are not in control of the Congress. So this is our Rufus King Senior Award for Outstanding Public Leadership. It's been received by a number of politicians around the country. I think from what you heard today from David, you can just imagine how quickly marijuana law reform would happen around the country if our state legislatures and city councils were populated with men and women like himself. And as I suggested in my remarks, I think that is happening. It's a fait accompli. It's called demographics. So Rufus King was one of Normal's first board members. He was the original marijuana activist in the 1950s and 60s. He got pinball legalized in the United States. And he was a fascinating guy. He really was. And so we make this award in his name, and we make it in 2015 to the District of Columbia councilperson, David Grosso.
Radio is brought to you by Sacred Serum, who is focused on creating elegant and sophisticated cannabis solutions through its line of dispensers and vaporizers that come preloaded with the world's finest cannabis concentrate. Sacred Serum's concentrate is made on pharmaceutical-grade supercritical CO2 extraction machines that use absolutely no butane or other toxic chemicals. The Vesica, the company's innovative new way to dab and frost, is now available in dispensaries across California. Sacred Serum. Elegance and sophistication.
420 Radio, the activist radio station.
The Fingerboard Extension has fretted instruments to enhance your creativity. It has new and used guitars and banjos from beginning to high class. The Fingerboard Extension has National Resophonic, Husson Dalton, Larrabee, Heritage and Recording King guitars, and Mike Ramsey, Wildwood, Gold Tone and Recording King banjos. The Fingerboard Extension also has drum stuff, used gear and parts. Stop by the Fingerboard Extension, downtown Corvallis, Oregon at 120 Northwest 2nd, or check out the inventory on the web at fingerboardextension.com and reverb.com.
Get .buzz. .buzz is the internet platform that fuels community interest, excitement, and new experiences. .buzz is the premier online destination for internet users seeking the latest news on a variety of topics. .buzz appeals to groups active in blogging, communications, journalism, advertising, and marketing. .buzz offers registrants a stronger alternative to the shrinking namespace of existing top-level domain names, such as .com, .net, and .org. Get your name now at get.buzz.
Support for 420 Radio comes from Kick-Ass Cannabis and Veggies, a guide to gardening with nature, authored by Kip Zonderkopf. Based on the ethos that a living soil is the foundation of a thriving garden, Kick-Ass Cannabis and Veggies is your guide to naturally growing resinous buds and nutrient-rich veggies. Get the ebook now with instant download at kickassorganics.com. Previews available on Amazon, iTunes, Nook, Google Play, Kobo, and many other online retailers.
And many thanks, Keith, for that great introduction. And I am very much looking forward to being off probation. So we'll be going through some of that. Up on the screen, I'm from Philadelphia, and you know, I've been working in marijuana politics for over a decade. I really want to thank Paul Armentano, Keith Strop, and Alan St. Pierre, who have always been both my mentors and supporters in this movement. And you know, when I was doing the podcast at National Normal, I got to interview Mitch Earlywine every week, and you know, I talked to activists all around the country. It was like going to a marijuana university. And after I stopped doing the podcast and moved back to the East Coast, I took all of that knowledge and said, you know, I've been talking with all these people, how do I put this into practice? So I've really been luckier than most to have had tremendous training and tremendous support in the ability to both collate facts on medical marijuana, hemp, decriminalization, full legalization, civil asset forfeiture reform, but also the ability and hearing from so many activists around the country how to talk to your local legislators. But I've never left the realm of street activism either. And I think that's the challenge for us today in this marijuana movement. There is a broad aspect that we have to speak to. I don't think that you can pigeonhole cannabis consumers into one category. Cannabis is a part of the American fabric of life. You've got Willie Nelson country music cannabis consumers. You've got hip-hop Snoop Dogg cannabis consumers. You've got Melissa Etheridge rocker cannabis consumers. You can't put them all into one category. And to the same extent, we also are bridging this gap. You've seen a sort of backlash in some ways against industry folks in Colorado and other states that have said, we're moving away from the stoner stereotype. We don't want to be like those Cheech and Chong stoners anymore. But to the same extent, as consumer advocates, we have to do both. We have to talk to legislators, but we also have to make sure that we're representing consumers. And again, those consumers can be soccer moms, and those consumers can be tie-dye wearing hippies, we have to be as inclusive as possible in that. And I think street activism also keeps us closer to our roots. On the screen, you see a wonderful woman named Abby, and she's holding a sign. I gotta give a shout out to Mickey Martin, often a critic of Normal and myself. But Mickey has a great phrase, and it's, I smoke weed and I'm a good person. And we say this at every rally, so I want everybody to do it today. So follow me. I smoke weed and I'm a good person. And when people ask you why you want to legalize marijuana, you say you're a good person. Your friends and your family members are good people. They don't belong in handcuffs. They don't belong in jail. They don't belong to have their whole lives taken away over a simple plant. So there's Abby holding a sign at one of our Smoke Down Prohibition rallies. And in the background, in the upper left-hand corner, you see a guy who was running for governor in Pennsylvania at the time, John Hanger. And John is now the chief policy secretary for our current governor, Tom Wolf. John ran on a platform of marijuana legalization. He came out to our rallies where we were smoking joints in front of the Liberty Bell, and now he's second in command of the state of Pennsylvania, and guess what? That's working. Governor Tom Wolf supports decrim. He won on that platform. And just last night, you know, we're going to talk about this in a minute, but I'm so excited because Jim Kenney, the guy who pushed through marijuana decriminalization in Philadelphia with us, a guy who was a city councilor at large for 16 years, just won the Democratic primary for mayor last night in Philadelphia. He's probably going to be Philly's next mayor. And you know what? In every single article, in every single appearance, he talked about the success with marijuana decriminalization. We are seeing that moment where politicians understand that cannabis is positive political capital. It wins elections. And that's going to be one of the things that changes this country. So there's a great shot of Abby right there. Let's move on to our next slide. There's us in front of Independence Hall. This is what we do. We get out on the streets, we hold signs, we go to historic locations. Now, here's the thing. We're in Philadelphia, and in the center of Philadelphia is this plot of land that is federal. And, you know, what we're here to do this week is to lobby Congress. Now, if you look at a map of Colorado or Washington, D.C. or Alaska, you're going to notice that a heck of a lot of the land, darn near 50% of it or more, is actually federal land. And what happened to me, and I will talk about this in a minute, is something that can happen to any cannabis consumer in the country under state legalization today, and that has got to change. We've got to start having a more meaningful conversation about federal marijuana decriminalization. But what gets the conversation started with politicians, in some ways, is street activism, and that's what happened in Philadelphia. So we go out, we have rallies, we go out in front of Independence Hall, we go out around City Hall, we hold signs, people honk their support, we have marches of thousands of people, as we just saw a couple of weeks ago, all around the country. And when you go into politicians' offices, especially at the local level, let me tell you, that really means something. It shows your support amongst the public, amongst voters. Next slide. Ooh, wrong button. That's Ray Lewis. He's a retired captain in the Philadelphia Police Department. You know, he was arrested at Occupy Wall Street, New York. I was one of those occupiers who camped out in front of City Hall too. You know, activism, Quaker stuff. But that's where I met Ray. He was arrested at Occupy Wall Street, New York. He's a retired Philadelphia police captain. And he started coming down to our Smoke Down Prohibition rallies and holding that sign. You know, I've always been great friends with Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, an amazing and wonderful group. But now you're seeing, you know, now you're seeing cops come out of the woodwork because of those guys, and just on their own. So, you know, it's folks like Ray who gave us a lot of local support, too, with Philadelphia. Yeah, indeed. He got into trouble for that, too. So there's me. This is what happens when you smoke a joint twice on federal land. You know, it wasn't just, when we did Smoke Down Prohibition, we committed to a year of monthly protests. Once a month, we're going to come down in front of the Liberty Bell. We didn't go into Independence Hall and try and smoke a bong next to the Liberty Bell or where the Declaration was signed. But there was actually a monument to the First Amendment at the corner of 5th and Market, where there's a free speech zone. We were outside, we're away from the tourist areas, and I've been protesting out there long enough, I know all the rangers and everything, that we really didn't have a problem. So December 2012, we start the protest, we get to April of 2013, and we have 600 people out there lighting joints. No problem, right? But then, once we had 600 people out there, they called the U.S. attorney. And the federal prosecutor in Philadelphia rolled out what was an army of law enforcement. We came with joints. They came with tactical weapons. We had Department of Homeland Security, Federal Protective Services, Philadelphia Police, Philadelphia Strike Force Police, SEPTA Transit Police, National Park Service Rangers in riot gear. I never knew the Park Service had riot gear for bears, but they do. They have green riot gear. It's amazing. So we went out there, and when you're on federal land and you get your first citation for marijuana, they write you a ticket, and it's a criminal misdemeanor for $175. You can pay it online. No harm, no foul. I did it. I went back in July. Oddly, Neil Franklin was there from Leap in July, actually, and that was the weirdest one because they cited a couple of people around me, but they let me smoke an entire joint. And smoking a whole joint in front of 300 law enforcement officers was the strangest high I've ever gotten, let me tell you. But I went back in August, and this is a picture from August. So I lit my joint in August, and the ranger came over to me and said, "Mr. Goldstein, is that marijuana?" I said, "Of course it is. Here you go. One day I'd like to share this with you." And you could see that, you know, I'm a dangerous Quaker. It took a National Park Service ranger, a Philadelphia police officer, and a tactically armed Department of Homeland Security member to contain me and take me over to a processing tent set up by the U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. And when they were writing out my ticket, the U.S. attorney, who was there, present, said, "Oh, no, 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 he doesn't get a fine. He gets taken to court." And they prosecuted me in federal court. My long relationship with Normal put me in touch with one of my greatest friends and an amazing human being named William Buckman. And Bill was a great member of the Normal Legal Committee and one of the few attorneys, I hate to say it because I wish it were more often, that people had the altruism that Bill did to represent people like me and so many others pro bono and fight cases in court. So, you know, when you get into federal court for marijuana, you know, if you get into municipal court, maybe you pay a lawyer $1,000. When you get to federal court, a lawyer won't talk to you for less than 10 grand, even for a joint. So Bill did about $40,000 worth of legal work for me for free over this joint. I smoked the most expensive joint in Philadelphia's history, by the way. They took me into federal court. They prosecuted me. It took them 4 months. And the federal law says that for any amount of marijuana on federal land, you can get up to 6 months in prison, up to a $5,000 fine, and up to 5 years on probation. So keep that in mind. In our legal states, or here in DC, where you're walking around with your state or locally legal marijuana, this is how the federal government can and does treat people, and that's how they treated me. I got 2 years of probation, supervised, I get drug tested at my house once a month, and a $3,000 fine, which they made me pay in 30 days. And thanks to Chris and so many other people here who contributed to my GoFundMe, because, you know, when the judge said, "Hey, you have 30 days to pay your fine," wasn't easy. But that's why what we're doing here today in Washington is so important. It's so important that people understand that while marijuana reform is at the state level, the federal government controls so much land around the country and has so much power and authority over us because of prohibition laws and simple possession at the federal level that we need to get on changing that right away. But that street activism in my arrest turned into a conversation with city government. Now, I've been lobbying the mayor and the police and the DAs to change the way we treat marijuana in Philadelphia for the last 5 years. On the right is N.A. Poe. He's a comedian and marijuana activist. In the center is Ann Gemmel. She's an education activist in Philadelphia. And then myself. We all met at Occupy Philadelphia and became great friends. And the three of us walked into a city councilor's office in November of 2013. And we brought him the data. Philadelphia was the only county in Pennsylvania that put people into handcuffs and holding cells for any amount of marijuana. In the rest of the state, they treat it as a summary. They don't put you in handcuffs. They don't take you into custody. They take you into court later on. But Philly was the only city every single day. And we had 400 arrests a month in Philadelphia for marijuana possession, small amount. So we talked to Jim Kenney, and of course, when we looked at the numbers, here's what's in, I'm going to get into this in another minute. You don't want to flood politicians with stats, but there are some statistics and pieces of data that resonate strongly. And having a racial disparity to the arrests and the fact that people of color bear the brunt of prohibition is something that really resonates among legislators. It makes them want to do something. And thank God that Jim Kenney decided to take up that call and push through decriminalization. There he is in the center. That's Jay Lasseter on the left. He's a LGBT activist in Philadelphia. And that's Jim Kenney, hopefully our next mayor of Philadelphia, there in the center after we signed the bill. Big numbers are tough to handle for legislators. So this is a great number. We talk about it all the time in Normal. Hey, 100 million Americans have tried marijuana. 6,000 people try it every day. It's tough to wrap your head around. That's why it's great to get on the local level with numbers. Again, that's the number of people arrested in the country. And 650,000, 700,000, 800,000. That's a hard amount of people to wrap your head around. But then you take it to the local level. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania has only one of two publicly available crime databases in the country. In New Jersey, when we were looking at marijuana arrests, we had to file Open Public Record Act requests with 10 different police departments. We did this with the New Jersey ACLU, and they sent us back a glut of data, and it was a pain in the ass to go through. But in Pennsylvania, I can log into the Pennsylvania Uniform Crime Reporting System and look up any offense by precinct, not just by city or county or state, but by precinct. I can tell you the gender and the age and the ethnicity of everybody that's arrested. And this is an incredibly powerful tool, not just for journalists, but for activists. This is what we turned up for Philadelphia, in a nutshell. So in the state of Pennsylvania, 18,000 arrests, adults, 20,000 total arrests, including juveniles. Sales cultivation. In Philly, here we are, 4,336 arrests in 2013 alone, 83% African American. Now, here's what's interesting, though. Okay, so when I brought this to the police and the mayor and everybody else beforehand, they would say, there's two common questions that I get back about this when you talk about arrests from politicians. Say, okay, well, there's 4,000 arrests. Politician says, hey, Chris, how do you know that person wasn't arrested with a joint and a gun? Great answer here. This comes from the FBI's Uniform Crime Reporting Database. And just like the 650,000 number, this 4,000 number, the UCR has an algorithm in it so that if you're arrested with a gun and a joint, you get classed under the gun. You're classed under the most serious crime you're committing at the moment. So I can guarantee that these 4,336 people who were arrested for pot, the most serious thing that they were doing at that moment, I wouldn't be able to see this number unless the most serious thing that they were doing right then at that moment was getting arrested for weed. Excuse me. The other important aspect is to calculate the cost of arrests. And just this year, we have a great tool for that, which is the RAND Corporation study of Vermont. RAND did a wonderful study on legalization in Vermont. And tucked into that study was the best estimate I've ever seen on the cost of an arrest. And Vermont is decriminalized, but hasn't eliminated arrests completely. So they're able to look at the cost of a summary versus the cost of writing a citation, right? So to arrest a marijuana smoker in Vermont and probably every other state, it costs $1,266. That accounts for the police time, the lab work, the fingerprinting, the photographing, everything that goes into an arrest. So you start calculating that out. Cost of arrests in Pennsylvania, $26 million a year. RAND estimated that the cost of arresting somebody for sales cultivation is higher because of all the investigative time and extra lab work and prosecution time, $8,500 per offender, $47 million a year. Do that for your state. You can at least find the statewide numbers for your state and calculate that cost. Bring that to your legislators, because if there's one thing that speaks to politicians, it's how much tax dollars they're spending on this problem. That's Mayor Michael Nutter signing the decriminalization bill. Now, it wasn't easy to get him to sign. He took 4 months. At first, he wasn't for it. Neither was Police Commissioner Charles Ramsey, who just recently led the task force on 21st century policing for President Obama. Ramsey and Nutter were against this policy change. They didn't like it one bit. But then something happened in between when we signed the decriminalization bill, or when it passed City Council and when Mayor Nutter signed it. And that was a phenomenon in this country of a greater conversation on criminal justice reform and how police and communities are interacting in the wake of Ferguson, Missouri, and so many other problems in so many other cities. It's the truth. Because the other question I get back from legislators when I talk about the racial disparity of arrests is cops will often say to me, I have a good relationship with police representatives. But even the cops that I like to talk to, and we're having what we called, it was funny, we'd meet at Dunkin' Donuts with the chief inspector of the Philadelphia police and the chief of SEPTA police, and we'd call it the donut meeting on marijuana. And they were very amenable to this. But even the cops who I think are good people would say to me, oh, Chris, you know, we get these racial disparities in arrests because that's just where we patrol. You know, we're in these neighborhoods of color all the time. But that's not true. There is something wrong with marijuana and the racial disparity because it doesn't exist for any other stinking crime, especially other drug crimes. Now, if it were true that the racial disparity existed because it's just where they were patrolling, then we would see this for cocaine and heroin arrests. We would see this for disorderly conduct arrests. But guess what? White people are arrested more often for those crimes in Philadelphia, and I'll bet you many other cities. Mike Nutter eventually signed the bill. On the left is Mike Weider. He's a U.S. Marine Corps veteran, combat veteran of Iraq. He's a member of Philly Normal, and he arranged with the Philadelphia police to get the first decriminalization citation. We set it up with the cops. He is in the rotunda in the center of City Hall in Philadelphia. And that is a police lieutenant who came on out. Mike lit his joint. He smoked it. They took the joint. They wrote him a ticket. Everybody smiled. Everybody was happy. Talk about police community relations right there, okay? It's a lot different than being put into handcuffs. Mike paid his $100 ticket, no harm, no foul. And in Philadelphia, what we have is a civil citation, which means it's never on your criminal record, which means that if you're on a job application or applying for the military or applying for public housing and they ask you, have you ever been arrested, you can honestly say, I've never been arrested. And you will not get drug tested. It will not get forwarded to Child Protective Services. Civil citation is a good middle ground between prohibition and full legalization. It sort of weans the system and police off of their addiction of arresting cannabis consumers that they've been fueled by for so long. Okay, so here's the dramatic decline, okay? So marijuana, here's 2014. You can see the arrests, 196, 220, this is just adults. 196, 226, 296, 293, boom, decriminalization, 67. It's amazing how fast, you know, when we pass medical marijuana laws, it takes years to regulate and implement. We pass legalization, years of regulation and implementation and waiting. Decriminalization, bam, instant effect. Unfortunately, the racial disparity hasn't gone away. We're looking at 2013 versus 2015. Yes, the overall arrests are down. But black cannabis consumers in Philly are still 7 times more likely to get arrested than white ones. Why? It does not make any sense. There is no reason in policy, in practice, in the world, why this racial disparity exists, other than the fact that marijuana prohibition has been a racist institution since the day it was created in the 1930s and continued in the 70s. Black and white arrests in Philadelphia by month. I mean, it's stark. 7 white people, 55 black consumers. Why? White people spend more money on marijuana and smoke it more often than any other ethnic group in America. They should be arrested more for it, you know? Here's opium and cocaine. In the Pennsylvania Uniform Crime Reporting System, opium and cocaine are classified in the same category. So I can't separate out opium and cocaine. They're in the same arrest category. But take a look at this. Marijuana versus cocaine and opiates. So they're about equal in 2013, more cocaine and opiates, but they're still almost at the same level. Same, you know, just about equal in 2014. Bam! First 3 months of 2015, what can police do? They can focus on different crimes. And you could see that the amount of cocaine opium arrests are 901. Marijuana arrests for 3 months, way down. But here's the other interesting thing. This is month by month for the first 3 months of 2015, black versus white, opium cocaine. You could see that white people get arrested for opium cocaine a heck of a lot more often. Again, if police were just patrolling neighborhoods of color, high drug crime areas, you should see that be a different number? So when police and politicians say, oh, the racial disparity, it's just where cops are, I don't buy it. Not one bit. That's not believable in the real world. There is an institutional racism problem that is particular to marijuana, which gives us a powerful tool for reform. And social, as a Quaker, I believe in this. The reason I'm involved with marijuana reform is because I believe in social justice. I believe that marijuana reform is a wrench in the gears of society, of criminal justice reform, of healthcare reform, of so many other issues. And that's why I work on it. I like what Bill Piper said earlier today about, you know, go lobby your legislators in something that's comfortable. Because again, back to this, you know, we don't like the stoner thing. You know, a lot of people are like, hey, if you're going to come to the state house and talk to legislators, you better be wearing a suit. Now, I got arrested in a suit, and I go to the state house in a suit. So I'm just kind of a suit guy. But I think, like Bill Piper said, you should go in what's comfortable. This is a bunch of Pittsburgh Normal members, and that's one of Pittsburgh Normal Women's Alliance Director Teresa Nightingale there with Governor Tom Wolf of Pennsylvania. They go in what's comfortable, and that's what works. We're going to work on statewide decrim. We have a really kind of a, as many of you are experiencing at the state level, when it comes to medical marijuana, Pennsylvania just passed last week a very watered down, very restrictive medical marijuana bill that's being heralded as the best model in the nation. And we have to be careful now on the medical marijuana issue. It is so popular amongst voters. It is so popular nationwide that nobody's going to come out and say, no, we're opposed to medical marijuana. What they say instead is, look, we're compassionate. We just want something with strict controls. And we believe in having this access. But we just want to do it right. I'll tell you what, you know who did it right? California did it right. California did it right way back in the day. And when because politicians are quick to say that, we don't want to be like California. Oh, yeah? I want Pennsylvania to look exactly like California when it comes to marijuana. Okay? And that actually resonates. You cut that off. Don't back down. Don't compromise. This is hard advocacy. Okay? Do not stand there and nod your head yes when they criticize California, Cheech and Chong, or stoners in general. You come back and you say, I smoke weed and I'm a good person. And that's the point of what we do here today. So take that message out to Congress tomorrow, and I'll be right there with you. Thank you so much.
Growing plants indoors can be a rewarding hobby, but electricity bills can go through the roof. Then you have to cool down all those big hot lights. It can drive a grower insane. With Lush LED lighting, you can solve many of these issues and double your rewards. Matt and his scientists have developed the perfect light for flowering plants with far less cost and heat. And the results? Very effective. Check out LushLEDLighting.com right now and tell them Radical Russ sent you.
Hey everybody, it's Radical Russ here from 420 Radio, inviting you to be like me and get your ink done at Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo, Fort Worth's most female-friendly, clean, sterile, awesome tattoo shop. Thomas and his crew are true artists who can design you a custom piece or use a design you bring in. Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo also offers all styles of tattooing as well as piercings and all-around fun. In the DFW area, stop by Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo and tell them Radical Russ sent you. Trust me, it'll feel awesome.
Good day, Tokers and Tokettes. Radical Russ here in Washington, D.C. at the George Washington University. We're a part of the Normal Legislative Fly-In, and I'm joined by Cliff Perry, the executive publisher. Is that the term for
family? Well, actually, it's a publisher, but I am also the CEO of our public company called Freedom Leaf. Our ticker is FRLF, Freedom Leaf, and we're just happy and thrilled to be a part of this normal congressional meeting here, National Lobby Day.
Now, Freedom Leaf, for the people that don't know, pretty new magazine out there. Give folks the kind of the philosophy behind Freedom Leaf.
Yeah, well, we are new. Thank God we've been reaching critical acclaim. We're only 6 months old, but we have some tremendous writers and contributors. We hoping or becoming the de facto news, editorial, multimedia, and entertainment company in this space.
That's fantastic. And if people want to get a copy of Freedom Leaf, the print edition, what do they do? I mean, where can they find it?
Well, the best way to get it, we're limited in our circulation in that we are in 160 states. I'm sorry, in 32 states, and we have 160 distributors. But unfortunately, the magazine goes quickly. So the only way you can really ensure you're going to get one is to subscribe. And that would be mailed to your house in a discreet envelope. And or you can read it online at www.freedomleaf.com. We have an e-zine portion over on the top of the right portion of the website, and you can read all of the copies from the first till the most current. They're all archived for your reading pleasure.
Yeah, it's excellent magazine. It's really supportive of Normal and Students for Sensible Drug Policy, and providing an outlet, you know, kind of our news, our little news magazine. And I've heard tell that it's going over really well at like veteran centers and
senior centers. It's very incredible in that it is, you know, it's the type of magazine that you can show to your mother, your father, your grandmother, your doctor, your lawyer, your congressman, your senator. There's no bongs and thongs. There's cheech and chong sometimes, but everything is done in a very, very professional and mature manner, educational, and we're getting the message across through art, fashion, and lifestyle.
Fantastic. Cliff, thanks you so much for doing the magazine and for being here and supporting the Legislative Fly-In.
Thank you, Russ. It's a pleasure.
This is Radical Russ encouraging you to take a look at the Weed Blog every day. Johnny Green and the staff at the Weed Blog are on top of all the latest developments in the fight to end marijuana prohibition nationwide. You can even get the Weed Blog on your smartphone by installing the Weed Blog app for iPhone and Android. If it's about weed, it's on the Weed Blog, including my original writing. So don't delay. Read the Weed Blog today.
You know Herb Thrasher from the Herb Thrasher Flower Hour. Now get ready for Herb Age Designs for the proud cannabis consumer. Herb Age Designs, lifestyle gear for the 420 friendly. Herb Age Designs, we've got frisbee golf discs and durable hemp gear. Herb Age Designs, we've got shot glasses, drinking glasses, coffee mugs, and beer cozies. Check us out on Facebook and online at herbagedesigns.com. And follow Herb Age and Herb Thrasher on Twitter.
Good day, Tokers and Tokettes. Radical Russ here at the Denina Center, I'm told, in Anchorage, Alaska, where you can see the huge line of people waiting to get in here to the Northwest Cannabis Classic. We've got some vendor booths outside the main area here, as well as a nice photo wall built up for everyone who might want to get their photo taken at the event. Let's take a look inside Northwest Cannabis Classic. This is the inaugural event. This is the first one of its kind in Alaska, so a lot of folks are really excited about this. But you can see it's a very, very big area here. And many of the types of vendors you would expect to see at a lot of these events. Just kind of wander our way through. We've got greenhouses and lighting. This is the VIP area where Jorge Cervantes will be doing his presentation, among others. And we have some Mr. Nice Seed Bank is here. CO2 butane extraction devices as well. And as every event should have, a air hockey table. This is the pro air hockey at that. Somebody's winning. All right. Got the main stage over here. Our friends from BioTracker here. How you guys doing?
Doing great. How about yourself?
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, is your first time in Alaska?
It is my first time in Alaska, actually, and I'm having a great time. It's beautiful here. Everybody seems really, really into the industry so far.
All right, we'll be back and talk a little bit more about BioTrack. I got a presentation at 1, so I'm just getting some footage. All right, let's see what we got over here. I do believe that's marijuana right there. Looky there, folks. Good old-fashioned American cannabis. Nice to see it. He's got a display glass here, got some Chem Dog.
22% THC, looking good. And accessories. There's always plenty of accessories to be had at one of these events. Here we're looking at one of the glass tables. Got some nails as well. And let's see if I can talk to this gentleman here, see what he's got going on. All right, we continue looking around. Cannabis shops are well represented. They've got some nice couch areas. How you guys doing?
Good.
See you guys.
448?
I'm out of Portland, Oregon, yes.
Nice. Welcome to Alaska.
Thank you.
Kush Gardens, Alaska.
Tell them all about it.
Kush Gardens. We'll be getting our license in a year.
Yeah.
Going to keep our heads low and play by the rules, jump through the hoops. Get our license, and we are going to be specializing in clones.
Oh, very good.
That's one of the things, is now everybody has this right to grow, but nobody thinks very much about where am I going to get my first seed from.
What we're wanting to do is have it set up to where you're allowed your three plants. Say your wife gave you one small closet out of the house, and that's all the space you're going to have. You can come visit us every 2 months, get all new clones, get them ready to bud, and get a 2 foot tall plant, if that's what you need, if that's the size you want,
yeah,
and ready to go.
I've been telling people that this whole idea of being able to take plants into like a real, real big vegetation mode and then just get them ready to flower, it's kind of like the Papa Murphy's take and bake of weed.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. It's like you don't have to do all the cooking, just throw it in the damn oven.
That's what we're looking to do, but we're also wanting to do it on a scale to where we can supply commercial growers and increase their profits by a good 15%.
Man, that's awesome. So give people a website or a phone number or whatever they need to contact you.
It's right now, just email. We're very low-key right now. It's kushgardensalaska@gmail.com.
All right.
kushgardensalaska@gmail.com. Thanks, guys. Have a good show.
Alaska. What's that? Welcome to Alaska.
Well, thank you very much. So moving around more in the event here, I like these guys have DB Cooper LED grow lights. DB Cooper lights that they grow your plants and then they jump out the airplane and leave you. No, I don't know what's going on with that, but we'll talk to those guys soon. Here's guys selling some t-shirts and such. Good stuff going on here. Rounding the corner, we have lots of different stuff for sale here. Little pipes, sacks, jet flame and such. All sorts of accessories available here. Even accessories of the adult variety. Keep this separate from the weed. The sticky icky and the lube do not go together. Do not go together. Not good. All right, and here we have, oh, this is interesting. What do you got here? What are these things?
These things are climate controllers.
Oh, okay. I gotcha.
Yeah, this is a CO2 controller. That's the health soil reading of CO2 in here. So.
Very cool. You're grow zone?
Yeah, I'm grow zone.
This is the Russ Belville Show. The Russ Belville Show is blogging and podcasting daily at RadicalRuss.com.